Welcome to Brain Core, the podcast that introduces you to new psychology and neuroscience research. I'm Tolu Feromika, and I'm joined by my co-host, Christina Valkanis. In our last episode, we tackled the topic of consciousness from a neurophilosophical point of view with Patricia Churchland, the founder of neurophilosophy. In this episode, we are continuing the conversation, but switching to a neuroscientific lens. Christina, do you want to introduce our guests?
Sure. Today we are joined by Dr. Adrian Owen, one of the scientists whose work actually piqued my interest when I was sitting in intro psych back in 2017. One of the experiments that he is known for is an MRI experiment where they got minimally conscious patients to think about either playing tennis or walking around their house to answer a question. So if they thought about playing tennis, that would light up different areas of their brain and it would represent them thinking yes. And then if they thought about walking around their house, I believe that was the thought for no, and it lights up spatial areas of the brain. Dr. Owen is originally from the UK. He runs the Owen Lab at Western University in London, Ontario. So he's kind of gone from one London to the next. And now he's doing a combination of MRI and EEG research, incorporating the theme of consciousness, which is why we'd like to welcome him to the show today. So welcome to the show, Adrian. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'd say I'm in the similar boat with Christina. I was introduced to your research in my intro to cognitive neuroscience class. And I remember it being so memorable that when we were on a panel, Christina and I, and they asked us what we thought was the most interesting thing or interesting find in neuroscience of recent, that's actually what came to mind for us. And so we both read your book, Into the Gray Zone. A neuroscientist explores the mysteries of the brain and the border between life and death, which came out in 2017. And I must say it was written in a great way. I feel like it caters to a vast audience, even if they're not embedded in the sciences. Would you say that that was on purpose?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I've been asked to write sort of several books in the course of my career, and I've been tempted to write several books during the course of my career. And I always shied away from it, thinking I'm not terribly interested in writing a science book. But this, as you say, is more of a story. It's in some ways, I think of it as a scientific detective story, really. It sort of brings together, the story of how we discovered this lost population of patients, with stories of the patients themselves and their families, with stuff that was going on in my own life at the time. So I saw it as a way of conveying some of the excitement of science, sort of wrapped in a more accessible package. So as you say, it's not really a book. I mean, scientists can read the book, and many of them have written to me to say they like it, but it's a book for everybody, really.
Right. I mean, I
tried to pass it on to my mom.
I appreciate that, because I think one of the reviews says it reads like a Sherlock Holmes investigative style story, and I have read a lot of Sherlock Holmes books as well as watched the shows and movies, so that's probably why I really liked it. But on our last episode with Patricia, we looked at consciousness from a neurophilosophical lens and discussed how the consciousness conversation changes from discipline to discipline. So from philosophy, biology, computer science. How would you say the consciousness conversation changes when one views it from a neuroscientific lens?
I think most of the people who are sort of seriously investigating consciousness in the neurosciences are sort of looking for what's often referred to as the neural correlates of consciousness. And that's not to say we're just sort of searching through the brain trying to find the consciousness spot, but we're trying to explain how our brain gives rise to every thought and feeling and sense of imagination and plan, everything that goes through our minds and every idea that comes to us, every experience that we have is somehow generated by our brains. And I think most people working in the neuroscience of consciousness are, that's what they're trying to explore. And of course, that explains why they're now, this is such a popular area to work in now, because there are many different things that you can do. In my particular area is trying to understand what happens you know, what types of brain damage lead to people being either unconscious or only partially conscious. So in my area, that would include things like, you know, as you said in the introduction, investigating patients who are in a vegetative state. They are supposed to be unconscious. And as it turns out, we've shown that some of them aren't unconscious at all. Some of them are entirely conscious and know exactly where they are, the situation they're in, and have witnessed every conversation that's ever been had in their presence. But also, I'm very interested in other states of consciousness that are brought about by alterations in brain states. So the obvious one is sleep. Every night, all of us go into at least some kind of altered state of consciousness. Whether we're unconscious or not is a matter of debate, but it's certainly not the same as being entirely awake. Mm-hmm. General anesthesia is another area that I'm very interested in, and we've carried out a bunch of anesthetic studies in the last few years, because now there you are very much unconscious. Something very mysterious about the situation of being, you know, completely anesthetized, because you have no sense of who you are, where you are, the situation that you're in, or indeed how much time has passed. That's one of the key characteristics of an anesthetic. If you go under, as I'm sure many people listen to this podcast have, you go under to have surgery, 9 or 10 hours can pass, and it's like that. It's like an instant. How does that happen? How does all that stuff get shut down in the brain? All that sense of that whole sense of being has completely gone for that period. Yet we survive. We come back from it, and you know, most of us are not at all altered by, you know, by the experience.
Right.
So there are many, you know, and that's just, you know, my area is, as I say, sort of working with alterations in consciousness. But of course, many people work on aspects of consciousness because they're interested in how memories are laid down, or how it is that we perceive the world. Why do we see things the way we see them? So there are many, many opportunities for neuroscientists to work on issues that are, you know, either involve changes in consciousness themselves or in understanding how the brain brings about consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a vast field. And I like that you mentioned sleep, because right before the interview last night, I was actually dreaming about the interview. And every time I find when I have something that I need to prepare for, like if I have an exam the next day, my dream will be just my mind trying to get me ready for that. So it's funny what goes on even when we're not as conscious as we usually are. We're not unconscious, but you know,
I mean, sleep's a really fascinating example for me, because I'm not a sleep expert. I've done a bunch of studies on sleep, and I've worked with many people who are sleep experts, but just working in the field in general, it's the one condition, if you like, situation that few people actually agree on it as far as levels of, you know, consciousness are concerned. So I will meet somebody one day who will say, obviously you're unconscious when you're asleep. And then, you know, the next day I'll meet somebody who says, well, of course you're conscious. I mean, you dream, and the dream is real, and you feel like you're, you know, in another, you know, it may not be that you can fly, but it feels like you're flying. So people where sleep is concerned, even many neuroscientists working within sleep will disagree about exactly what our state of consciousness is when we're asleep. And obviously it gets a bit more nuanced, because there are different stages of sleep. And, you know, the stage that you're in when you're dreaming does seem to be a little bit more like you're awake, but it's not the same as being awake. I mean, it's my opinion, but it's not exactly the same as being awake. It does feel kind of real, but it's not the same. Whereas some parts of deep sleep are more like general anesthesia, where you have no idea, you know, where you are and what's going on. But of course, the difference between anesthetic and sleep is you can always wake somebody who's sleeping up. You know, it's more difficult for some of us than others. But typically, if you, you know, prod somebody or give them a shake, they'll wake up however deeply asleep they are. It's not the case with general anesthesia. You cannot wake somebody up.
Well, speaking of opinions, actually, when we had Patricia on, we asked her about the whole mind-brain debate. And if we take her idea, she said that the mind is the brain, or the brain is the mind, rather than taking on a dualist approach to this problem. So I know you touched on this in your book a little bit, but what are your thoughts on this mind versus brain kind of issue.
Oh, I think that, I mean, of course I'm not a dualist, and I think I think any self-respecting neuroscientist really shouldn't be a dualist either. I mean, we seek to explain how it is that this physical thing inside our heads gives rise to every experience that we have. Now, that doesn't mean that I think the mind is not a useful concept. You know, I work at the Brain and Mind Institute. I run a program for CIFAR called Brain, Mind and Consciousness, right? But I think it's a useful descriptive term to describe this, the experience of having a brain and what that gives us, right? But that doesn't mean it's a different thing. I mean, I absolutely think that everything that we have that we think of as mind comes from our brain. The fact that we can't join all the dots between them, you know, I have no problem with that at all. I mean, many people who, you know, are dualists, you know, will say, well, how can you possibly explain all the amazing experiences we have just based on this, you know, lump of gray and white matter inside your head? And, you know, there are many, many things we don't understand about the universe, but that doesn't make them not true, or doesn't mean that we have to come up with a sort of metaphysical explanation for them just because we don't understand them. I'm quite sure at some stage we will completely understand consciousness, and to get to that solution, what we will have done is understood how the nuts and bolts, the physical machinery of the brain, the, you know, from the neurons to the, you know, to the connective tissue, to the lobes and our entire sort of anatomical, the entire anatomical structure, we will understand how that gives rise to the sense that we have a mind. But you know, you're right. I mean, I reflected on this in my book a lot. I kept coming back to this statement, we are our brains, right? And I mean, I'm very fond of this idea. And again, you know, it's not everybody would agree with me, but and the point I made in the book is that, you know, the brain is the one thing you can't replace, right? And the example I used is, you know, we live in a world where people have heart transplants and lung transplants and liver transplants, and those people don't become a different person afterwards. They might be a little bit changed, a bit bruised. They may reflect on their experiences, but they haven't fundamentally changed. But as soon as you say, well, what if we get to the stage, and, you know, we're halfway there already, but, you know, where you could remove my brain and put somebody else's brain into my body, who would I be? You know, would I still be Adrian? Well, I think most people intuitively think, no, you wouldn't. You'd be the person whose brain, you know, you'd look like Adrian.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have the memories of Adrian. I wouldn't have the plans that Adrian had. I wouldn't have the, I've learned all the, you know, the ways of interpreting the world that Adrian had. So I very much think we are our brains in the sense that if theoretically you could move your brain around, you would move around with the brain. You wouldn't move around with the body or any other organ, to be to be fair. So, and I'm very fond of this notion.
Right. I like that you mention the different functions that I think maybe you would call them scaffolds of consciousness in the book, where in the experiments that you did, it was kind of looking at the ability for the patients to pay attention for the duration of the test, the ability for them to understand the instructions being given while they're in the fMRI, the ability to know the answer to the question you're asking, like, is their father's name Bob? Or the ability to even remember the instructions that were given at the start. So we also asked Patricia this as well, and so I'll ask you it as well. Do you think that consciousness is special in comparison to these other functions like attention, language, memory?
Only insofar as it might be a little bit more complex, but I think it incorporates many of those functions. You know, without attention, you're not going to have consciousness, really. You know, without aspects of memory, you're not going to have consciousness. I mean, the way, maybe give you an illustration, but, you know, when something comes into my world, the way I interpret that thing is partly based on my memories for these things. You know, when I don't know, I pick up an orange, or I see an orange, I know it's a fruit. I know that it's probably been grown in another part of the world, so it's probably traveled here. I know that I can eat it. I know what it tastes like. I know how to deconstruct it, to peel it. Now, these are all things that are in my memory. And, you know, if this was the first encounter that I'd have with an orange. A lot of those things I wouldn't know. But, you know, I would draw on other aspects of my knowledge that I would have also remembered about fruits in general. I would look at it, you know, I have a habit of buying exotic fruits for my son. We have this game where I try and pick up a fruit that he's never seen before. Mm-hmm. He's 7 years old. And, you know, and we eat the fruit, you see. And but it's not, you know, and sometimes I do have to Google, well, how do I peel this fruit? Or do I eat the skin or not of this fruit? Mm-hmm. But I basically, you know about, you know, it doesn't matter. Even if it's a fruit I've never seen before, I basically know that it's probably the bit inside that you eat. And it's probably going to be sweet. Mm-hmm. You know, and there might be, you know, pips or seeds that I can't eat. And, you know, there's and again, my whole sort of conscious experience of being presented with this new and exotic fruit that I've never seen before is shaped by everything that's ever happened in my life before that has anything to do with fruits. I've gone off the subject. I've actually forgotten what your question was.
Whether you think consciousness is special in comparison to those other functions.
Yeah. So yeah, that's right. So yeah, I mean, I think it's special in that it's, you know, it's a little bit more complex. So it's going to take probably a bit longer to work it all out. But, you know, I mean, we shouldn't pretend that we understand attention.
Right.
We shouldn't pretend that we understand memory. Mm-hmm. There are thousands of neuroscientists still with very secure jobs who are investigating how the brain gives rise to memory. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think maybe people who are not neuroscientists or are outside the field imagine that we understand memory and we understand attention and we understand vision. But all of these things are still very much, you know, being investigated, and every year new neuroscientific methods come along that allow us to look at them with even more precision than we've ever done before, or look at them in a different way. And so, you know, like consciousness, we don't really understand memory either. So I'm guessing that it's going to be a bit more complex, but it's not because we've solved all these other problems and we're left with this difficult issue of consciousness. But you started that question by talking about the scaffolds of consciousness. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. It was an expression that I used in the book. And it came, building blocks of consciousness is another way I often think about my approach to understanding this. And in some ways, it is quite the opposite of the classic philosophical model. And it's obviously not true of all philosophers, but a sort of a classic philosophical way of trying to understand consciousness is to look from above and sort of think, well, let's try and work out what it is and what's it for, and how have we got it and how can we use it, and maybe that'll help us explain, you know, where it comes from and how it works. Mm-hmm. So way of doing things has always been the other way up, which is to try and work out, well, you know, here's a brain doing stuff. Is it conscious or not? Okay, let's get it to do a bit more stuff. And if you use the example of the patients who are vegetative, you know, basically we started that series of studies by doing very simple things like showing these patients pictures of friends and family.
Yeah.
And when we did that, this is going back to the late 1990s now, you know, we found that some patients who we put into a brain scanner, and the parts of their brain that we know are involved in recognizing faces, mm-hmm. would respond when we showed them a familiar face. So, of course, you know, you immediately think, okay, that's interesting. They're recognizing the face.
Yeah.
But as I, you know, spent some time discussing in the book, recognizing a face is not, or your brain recognizing the face is not the same thing as you having the conscious experience of seeing a familiar face and recognizing it.
Yeah.
Because when you actually see a familiar face, you get a flood of information that comes in. Like, you know, that's my Uncle Bob. You know, I remember he used to take me to the park when I was 6 years old. He's the brother of my mother. And, you know, it's all this sort of stuff accompanies just simply recognizing a face. You know, computers are quite good at recognizing faces now, as most people listening to this will know. It doesn't mean they have a conscious experience of face recognition, right? Mm-hmm. So this is where we got to in the early days of the vegetative state work. We'd see these signs of consciousness. And clearly, if you're conscious, you can recognize faces, typically, not always. But it's not enough.
Yeah.
Recognizing faces alone is not enough to be conscious. And so we sort of added another layer. Well, can they not only recognize faces, but can they recognize speech, for example? Can they comprehend speech? And as you sort of go up this ladder, this hierarchy of cognitive processes, you do get to a point, and this is what I mean by scaffolding, you do get to a point where you have no choice but to accept that this person is conscious. You know, once you show that they can understand speech, they can recognize faces, they can they can remember things, they can convey things back to you that you've asked them to remember, at some stage you realize that despite the fact that they are physically non-responsive and they're not doing anything in the world, their mind, their experience of consciousness of the world is exactly the same as yours and mine. And that's how we ended up concluding that some patients who appear to be vegetative are in fact conscious, mm-hmm. because there wasn't anything that they couldn't do that a normal person couldn't do. We weren't able, you know, apart from get up and walk around, you know, getting up and walking around. We have robots that do that and they're not conscious. So getting up and walking around is not a good indicator that somebody's conscious. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I like to build things up from the bottom. And I hope one day that in that way we'll be able to understand and explain consciousness.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned robots because I was reading another book too that's now looking at AI and wondering if we'd ever be able to say AI is conscious, depending on like how far it develops.
Yeah, there was a Safar talk on that recently, whether AI has consciousness.
But I think go ahead.
Well, we have in the program that I, the Brain Mind and Consciousness program that I direct on, it's run by the CIFAR, Canadian organization. There's another program which is very much about AI, and we get together with them from time to time and sort of debate this exact issue. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's very difficult. And it's very difficult, I think, because people come from this, from entirely different directions. And I mean, this is where the philosophy does become important, because one of the issues that we often find when we talk to people who are experts in AI about whether their AI is conscious or whether it could ever be, is that we actually fundamentally disagree about what we mean when we say consciousness, and that's where the philosophy becomes important, and that's where sort of understanding, trying to get on the same page. What are you actually talking about here? Is really important. And this is, my other sort of favorite little mind game, if you like, is thinking about other animals, other species, or other times in development. I mean, the example, again, I spend quite a lot of time talking about in the book is development, babies, mm-hmm. And I go mm-hmm. from sort of saying, well, do people, if you ask most people, and, that's just that's not a very scientific approach, but it's a good way of working out what people really think. And if you ask people whether a single cell organism is conscious, most people are happy to say no, probably not. If you ask them whether 21-year-old human being is conscious, most people say, well, yeah, of course they are. Mm-hmm. So somewhere between those two places, that thing became conscious, somewhere between conception and being a living human. And we've done this sort of experimentally. You could say, what about somebody who's 10, 10-year-old? Well, yeah, of course they're conscious. Okay. What about a 1-year-old? Well, and I think you get into this, what happens very quickly is people start to think, well, yeah, they are conscious, but obviously their consciousness is different to mine, right? A 1-year-old is not experiencing the world in the same way that I'm experiencing the world, and a lot of that has to do with memories and representations in the brain and expectations that I've developed over the course of my life that, that a 1-year-old isn't going to have. So it is really fascinating because, once you start to try and put labels on these things, it becomes clear that, it depends becomes very important. Yeah. It depends what you mean by consciousness. It depends whether we're talking about adult humans or another species or children, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you have like your own sort of definition of consciousness that you fall back on when you get into these debates with people, or is it kind of something more?
No, I mean, I was actually glad that you didn't start this interview by saying, what's to you?
What is it?
That is the most common first question I get. Or the other one that I really hate is, what is your theory of consciousness? You know, and I hate it because I don't have a theory of consciousness. And I don't think that makes, you know, what I do any less important or interesting, because I think just because you have a theory of consciousness doesn't mean that it's right. And in most cases, I think it's probably woefully wrong, because if somebody had the right theory of consciousness, we'd have cracked it and understood it by now. Yeah. So, you know, is it better to not have a theory of consciousness or to have a wrong theory of consciousness? I don't know, you know. And so I'm not trying to duck the question here, but I don't think it's the right question to ask. What is consciousness? Because as my friend and colleague Anil Seth, he often uses the example of life, right? I mean, he says, well, you know, what is life? You know, ask somebody to define life. What is your theory of life? Well, you know, just because you can't come up with a theory of life or even define life doesn't make life any less real. You know, and consciousness is the same. So yeah, again, you know, I guess I am ducking the question, because I don't think the answer is very useful. I think it's much more useful to try and answer the question, you know, is this person conscious, you know? And and I've made this argument many times in the past. You know, this has been my sort of crusade, if you like, for many years, is to take a patient who has very severe brain damage and try and work out whether they're conscious or not. And I don't need a theory of consciousness to answer that question, for the same reason that if I was trying to work out if the patient was alive or not, I don't need a theory of life to do that, right? It's a case of measuring, finding ways of measuring these things, and measuring the extent. In the case of consciousness, the approach I always take is measuring the extent to which somebody's, you know, internal mentations, if you like, are like mine. If somebody is experiencing the world just like me, you know, I don't care whether they've been diagnosed as being in a vegetative state or a coma. I don't care if they're a dolphin or a lobster. If their experience of the world is the same as mine, I will conclude that they are conscious.
Right.
Of course. I like that answer.
Yeah, I like it as well. I mean, in our last episode, I did say that we wouldn't make our term of the episode consciousness, because I don't think anyone can really define it or put that label on it. But you did mention the cases that you've done on individuals who are in a vegetative state. And there are some that you mentioned in the book, like Kate, Debbie, Kevin, Scott, and so on. So what would you say has been the most interesting or surprising case you've encountered, and could you maybe describe it for listeners who may not know about the gray zone or the studies you've done?
I could pick many. I mean, there are many, as you said, there are many fascinating examples in the book, and I tried to pick different cases, you know, patients that had different circumstances or different histories, to give people an idea of how interesting all of these cases can be. So that's the most surprising. So let me start. I mean, obviously, I would say the most impactful on my life was the patient in 2006 that we discovered, and this was published in the journal Science. We discovered for the first time that a vegetative patient could actually be entirely conscious. And as you said in your generous introduction, we got her to imagine playing a game of tennis, and the areas of her brain that we knew activate when somebody imagines playing tennis lit up, and she could do this repeatedly over and over again. And that was, I mean, that was honestly the single most important moment in my entire career, because, you know, everything has changed for me after that discovery. But, you know, she that patient wasn't the first. There were patients before her, but, you know, this goes back to the, you know, the case of Kate you mentioned, the early studies where we were looking at face recognition. All that stuff was really intriguing to me at the time. It was, wow. So if you can show this patient pictures of friends and family and the parts of the brain that we know are involved in face recognition light up, and does that make her conscious? So they were sort of interested in a way that was really piquing my interest and driving me forward. But it really wasn't until the 2006 discovery, where we were basically asking this patient to think things, and she would think them, and we would detect that with the scanner, and we'd go, wow, she can do that. Let's try something else. Let's get her to imagine walking around the rooms of her home. And if she can do that, this part of her brain should light up. Wow, that's lighting up now as well. So, you know, that sort of scientifically was the was the most exciting sort of set of circumstances, I mean, in my career, even, you know, outside of the work on consciousness. But the, I mean, one story that if you haven't read, for people who haven't read the book, won't know, is the case of Juan. In many ways, was the most extraordinary case person that I've, you know, come across. And this was a patient who came to us here in London, Ontario. He'd been in supposedly in a vegetative state for many months. We put him into the scanner, put him through the whole sort of series of tests. We had him here for an entire week, and, you know, we couldn't find any evidence that he was conscious. And, you know, I sat down with his family afterwards and said, "I'm terribly sorry. We can't find any evidence that this you know, your son is anything other than you know, unaware of where he is and who he is and the situation he was in." And then 9 months later, my research coordinator called up his mother. We do this to all of our patients, just to sort of follow them up. And she said, "Okay, how's Juan doing?" Really meaning, has there been any change in his condition? And Juan's mother said, "Well, why didn't you ask him?" And, you know, Juan was able to come to the phone and answer these questions. And as soon as I heard that, and this is, to my knowledge, this is this is one of the very few occasions. I mean, you'll read about it in fiction all the time, about people recovering after years in a coma, and this really doesn't happen very often. It's extremely rare. And this is the only case in my career where somebody has really made a stunning recovery, and it's the "and" that's important, which is that he could remember everything that happened to him while he was supposedly in a vegetative state. So, you know, we brought him back to London, Ontario, didn't tell him anything about his experiences, but we did a memory test, and we said to him, "Well, you know, do you remember who did this particular procedure on you?" He said, yeah, I remember, that was Steve. He was one of your graduate students. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Okay, what do you remember about Steve?" "Well, Steve had a very deep voice." Well, Steve was one of my graduate students. He did have a very deep voice. And yes, it was Steve that tested him on the day. You know, "Do you remember being scanned?" "Yeah, I remember being scanned. You put me in the scanner, you showed me an old black and white Alfred Hitchcock movie," which is exactly what we did, mm-hmm. For reasons that, you know, I won't go into here. But he could remember every single detail. And this is going back 9 months, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I couldn't remember whether or not we'd shown him the Alfred Hitchcock movie 9 months earlier. I certainly, you know, vaguely remembered a few details about it. But, you know, and I said to him, "Well, how did you remember all of this stuff?" And he said, "Well, I had nothing else to do, did I?" You know, and he was there locked inside himself,
yeah.
Just watching, listening, remembering. And I do think this is the only case in history where this has ever been, you know, fully documented, where somebody has appeared to be entirely vegetative, but in fact they were completely aware, and they came back from that and they were able to tell you all about it. You know, I have a few other patients who have vague memories of coming around or can report a few things, but for somebody to give that sort of level of explicit detail, mm-hmm. it really brings it home to you how real this is. These patients, you know, this guy was having feelings. I mean, he said to me, I cried when you put me into the scanner because I was afraid. Mm-hmm. Well, there weren't tears in his eyes at the time because we'd have seen that.
Mm-hmm.
But in somewhere in himself, you know, he was crying. And it shows, you know, you can exist entirely consciously, you know, without there being any evidence of that to the outside world.
Right.
I was going to say, that's almost like, it's miraculous almost in a sense. One of the things that really impacted me while I was reading the book was the impact that your findings had on the quality of healthcare that patients with low consciousness were receiving. I remember back when I was doing my lifeguard certification, when we were doing the first aid training, my trainer told me, doesn't matter if they're conscious, unconscious, whatever, however you find a victim, talk to them because they might be able to hear you. But in the book, as you said, I guess sometimes when we would label a patient as vegetative, you kind of lose that sense that they might be able to react. But then we see with Juan, even if your scanner shows that they might not be experiencing the world like we can, there's still this possibility that they are having conscious experiences, even if they can't demonstrate it like other patients could. But what I wanted to ask was, have you guys worked on any other methods of connecting with these patients to kind of get to the bottom of that?
Yeah, so we're working with a new technique at the moment. I said earlier, you know, one of the great things about working in neuroscience is that you get to try lots of new and exciting things as they come along, and things are always changing. And we have a technique now that's relatively new called functional near infrared spectroscopy, and or FNIRS, as it's often referred to. It's very similar in a way to fMRI, in that you're using blood oxygenation as a sort of a proxy for brain activity. So like with fMRI, the idea is that the bits of the brain that are working hardest at any given point in time, they need more energy to be delivered, and that energy is delivered in the form of oxygen through the blood supply. So if you can sort of measure how oxygen is moving around the brain, you can get a sense of which bits of the brain are working hardest or involved in a particular task. And FNIRS does that in a way that's a little bit more sort of localized, I suppose, than fMRI. So that's not a very good way of putting it. What I really meant to say is that it's a much more portable technique. So you don't have to take the person to the scanner, because the scanner weighs 10 tons and you can't move it around. You can take the FNIR system, which packs into a suitcase, to the patient. And you can, for the sorts of studies that we do, where we're trying to detect whether a particular part of the brain responds, say, when somebody's imagining playing tennis, we can do that just as well with a portable technique like FNIRS as we can with something like fMRI. And what that means is it opens up the opportunity to do much more of this. Because what, you know, one of the things that sort of held us back is that because fMRI is not portable, because it's relatively expensive, there's only so much you can do to a patient. I mean, I think our record was to scan a patient 18 times. Another patient I talked about a lot in the book, Scott, where we set up a channel of communication. He could tell us how he was feeling and whether he was in pain and these sorts of things. That was 18 trips to the scanner. Each one was a couple of hours long. An enormous amount of time and effort and computing power and money went into establishing that channel of communication. Of course, in my opinion, entirely worthwhile, but it was a kind of slow way of getting there. If we had a portable method where we could just pop it on the person's head, start asking them questions while they're still lying there in their bed, in their home or the hospital or whatever, it would make things a lot easier. And it would make the science move faster. I mean, we've learned so much from these patients. Juan, for example, we learned so much about consciousness and memory from the fact that Juan could come back and report it all to us. But the rate that we currently do science, I'm going to see one Juan every 25 years. But if we can do this faster and more efficiently, we can see more patients, we can spend more time with each patient, and thus we can learn more. And I think FNIRS is really important. It's going to be a really important tool in the future for really pushing things forward, for seeing more patients. Because many patients actually can't go into an fMRI scanner either. It's too dangerous to move them, or there are physical reasons why they can't fit in the scanner, these sorts of things. And FNIRS gets over some of those problems. So I'm pretty excited about that at the moment.
Yeah, I would be pretty excited about that too. Do you still use the EEG?
We're still using the EEG. I'm sorry to report the battery is flat, because it's not moved in about a year in the pandemic. So I did go and try and start it up a week or so ago. And unfortunately, the battery's gone flat. But in non-pandemic times, we are still using the EEG. We drive around. We use it for things other than EEG now often. So for example, the FNIRS fits into a suitcase in the EEG. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's how we get out to see the patients in the community.
Have you guys explored some of the consumer grade wearable devices that are coming out nowadays? Would you ever consider using them?
We have. And I'm not going to name any consumer devices in particular. Yeah. I think there's a slight disconnect between what is actually possible and the sort of public perception of what is possible. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody is sort of particularly to blame for this. You know, I think people do have this sense that, I know people have this sense because at least twice a week, somebody will write to me and say, well, why haven't you used the so-and-so device for doing this? Mm-hmm. And the reason is so-and-so device won't work for the purposes that, you know, that we want, we're trying to do. So, for example, with consumer level EEG devices, where you've just got a couple of electrodes that are just picking up either information from a very few regions of the brain, or even a lot of the information is not the brain at all. It's coming from, you know, areas around the head, the musculature and things. Mm-hmm. It's not possible to get the sort of precise localization that we need. I mean, when we are trying to decide whether a patient is conscious or not, we really need to be very specific about detecting activity in a particular part of the brain at a particular time. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to sort of put some flesh on that argument, you know, it's not that, you know, as I think most people understand this, the brain isn't a silent organ. It's not just sort of sitting there asleep until you ask it to imagine playing tennis when it wakes up and starts thinking about tennis. Your whole brain is active all of the time. And when we're using a technique like fMRI or EEG for that matter to detect brain activity, what we're really detecting is a change in brain activity. We're saying, okay, when this person imagines playing tennis, we know there's going to be an increase in activity above baseline in that particular area of the brain. And it might be a very small area of the brain. Mm-hmm. It might be a really tiny increase, a few fractions of a percentage in changes. But, you know, the technology, you know, at the high end, the sorts of research tools that we use, the technology is good enough to detect these tiny changes in small places. Mm-hmm. But consumer devices don't do that. They are looking for big, you know, general changes in very non-specific areas. So that's not to say they're not useful for some applications, but they are not tools that we can readily adapt to detect awareness or to communicate with vegetative state patients.
Yeah, that makes sense. That you would want that localized find as opposed to like a big wad of general data. But perhaps we'll make this the term of the episode. You mentioned, and this will probably be the title of the episode as well, this lost population that you've been able to conduct research on. And the title of the book is Into the Gray Zone. So how would you define the gray zone?
It's funny. So I didn't choose the title.
Oh, okay.
I actually didn't want the book to be that title. I think I can say that now because 3 years have passed or 4 years have passed, but it was my publishers. They really thought. I mean, I was more thinking of a title that was a little bit more obvious, like Alive Inside was a favorite one of mine. You know, the person is alive inside, or you know, locked in, or something like this. It was a little bit more descriptive. Into the Gray Zone to me sort of raised thoughts of, I don't know, submarines in the Bermuda Triangle or something. It had all sorts of connotations that had nothing to do with the brain. So although, you know, technically I think I coined the term the gray zone in this context, it wasn't my choice at the time. I don't think it's a bad, I still don't think it's the best title, but for a book. But I don't think it's a bad way of explaining what we're talking about here. And that's because I hear it often used in everyday language in other contexts. People will say, oh, it's a bit of a gray zone, isn't mm-hmm. it? Or, you know, it's a bit of a gray area. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what they mean is it's the bit in between that you don't really understand, or it's not perfectly defined. You know, when you say, well, you know, is this person going to be, you know, is this person going to be fined for what they did? Well, it's a bit of a gray area because it's not clear whether or not, you know, whatever they did was illegal or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And what we mean by that is, you know, we haven't quite worked out the nuances of the bit in between. You know, it's clear who should be fined and who shouldn't be fined. But what about those people that it's not clear about? And that's the way I feel about consciousness, really. You know, so these patients, at least at the time that I was writing the book, you know, for many of them, it wasn't that they are absolutely conscious or they're absolutely not conscious. They're somewhere in between and they're in a place that we don't fully understand. And that applies to sleep. And I've already used this example that, you know, half of my colleagues think sleep is an unconscious state and half of them think that sleep is a conscious state. Well, there's the evidence area. That it's a gray zone, right? It's a gray mm-hmm. area. And, you know, it's true of we've mostly focused on the vegetative state, but another condition that actually accounts for many more patients after severe brain injury, something called the minimally conscious state. Mm-hmm. And just by its title, you can tell that it's a gray zone. Minimally conscious, well, what does that mean? Does it mean that these patients are at a lower state of consciousness than the rest of us? Or does it mean that they're sometimes fully conscious and sometimes fully unconscious? There's many ways of being minimally conscious, right? And that's true. All of those things exist. There are patients who are versions of all of those things. And for me, you know, they're very much in the gray zone. They're in an area that we don't understand and we can't be fully confident that we know what their world is like.
Right. I would say that, you know, consciousness is this big subject because it's asking if the person's essence is still intact. And I feel like with the idea of the gray zone, it goes further and asks where that essence is, if it's still there. And so this kind of work, I would imagine, has big implications for like medical ethics and the laws which govern the care of seemingly unconscious individuals or minimally conscious individuals. In fact, you mentioned some cases in the book. Are the legal implications something you think about when conducting the studies?
Oh, all the time. And it's something that I've got more and more involved with over the years. I've just been involved in a case in Louisiana, for example, of a patient who was supposedly in a vegetative state. Mm-hmm. And there, because it was an American case, the amount of care that she receives, this was a sort of legal case involving a case against the person who put them into a vegetative state. Mm-hmm. It was an accident. And, you know, the level of care that they are likely to receive very much depends upon their quality of life or what their life is assumed to be. And by that, I mean that, you know, if the patient is permanently vegetative and is never going to make a recovery and has no sense of being, then, and I'm not saying I agree or disagree with this, but an argument could be made by a court, well, it's not worth investing a lot of money in this person because they have no sense of who they are and where they are and the predicament they're in anyway. Mm-hmm. If one could show that person is actually conscious and is, you know, trapped inside their brain rather than, or trapped inside their head rather than you know, being completely vegetative, then I think most people would think, well, yeah, you probably would want to extend additional privileges to that person, spend more money on making them comfortable because they're having an experience. They're experiencing their lives, even though they can't get up and move around. I mean, arguably, you should give them even more than a fully able person is because they're, you know, so sort of restricted. So, and these cases are coming up more and more often. And, you know, I'm very happy to weigh in and get involved and try it, you know, because it's a way of investigating, you know, what circumstances are like for different patients. So, you know, there are a lot of legal ramifications and you know, these things are cropping up much more often in the courts now than ever before.
Okay. Well, we'll round things off a little bit and end on a light note. I noticed that you're in a band called Untidy Naked Dilemma. You play guitar and sing in it. Did COVID disrupt that a little bit?
Oh, completely. Yeah. Actually, the band, we shared the title Untidy Naked Dilemma. The band is now called BAM. BAM. It's sort of like Wham, but rockier. I mean, I've played in bands for 25 years now, but the pandemic completely disrupted the band because we played our last gig, I think, in January 2020, last year, just before the pandemic sort of hit.
Yeah.
And we were playing sort of regularly up until that point. And of course, you know, with social distancing and everything, we've had no opportunity to gig since then. We have released a couple of songs because we've been able to record virtually, and you know, I have a recording sort of set up at home, and we made a couple of videos. I mean, people can find this very easily on YouTube. We recently released a version of Revolution by the Beatles, which was rewritten to be Vaccination. it's time to get your vaccination.
Right.
And it was really a celebration of the science involved in the development of vaccines, mm-hmm. because, you know, we used a lot of the lines from the original song, but things like, you know, we could switch it slightly with things like, there's been a science revolution, right? And it was really encouraging people to go out and get vaccinated.
Yeah.
That was pretty successful. It got played by CBC and we had a lot of airplay, both locally and across the country. So that's been great fun to do. We had another one. Last year we released a song called Stay at Home to the tune of Start Me Up by the Rolling Stones, mm-hmm. which again was quite successful. We got something like 20,000 views across the country and again it was played on national radio. So mm-hmm. We've been finding creative ways of making music despite the pandemic, and it's a good way for me to relax and think about something other than consciousness for a while.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Christina and I met in concert band, so we both play clarinet, piano, and so I'd say like music is pretty important to us, so it's nice to know that one can still find time to engage in enjoyable hobbies while conducting important research. But yeah, so with that, we come to a close. Adrian, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
For sure. I always find these conversations surreal almost. I think in class, we're introduced to interesting findings and ideas of the researchers behind them, but it's difficult to conceptualize how someone got to that point because you don't know what's going on behind the scenes. In fact, I've realized even if you do know what's going on behind the scenes, you could still be clueless. But one thing I think that really helps to solidify the process behind all of that is simply having a conversation with the researcher. And I think that's why I always enjoy the conversations we have on the show. That said, if listeners are interested to learn more, I'll put a link in the bio for the book we talked about. We'll also be continuing our consciousness conversation next month. But if you want to join in, you can always email us. Our email is thebraincorepodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram at The Brain Core Podcast and on Twitter at The Brain Core Pod. If we get some interesting comments, we'd be open to definitely reading them on the show in the upcoming episode. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we always appreciate a rating or a comment. It always helps to boost the show. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you are having a great brain day.